Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. It's Thursday. I'm expecting some groovy music, and you can look forward to 2 hours of Jimmy Akin. It's open forum. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin, of course, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, author of many things, including The Bible is a Catholic Book, and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, where new episodes drop each Friday, and we're now over 302 episodes, looking for 303 this week. Jimmy Akin, welcome.
Howdy. We're actually over 301 numbered episodes, looking for 302 this week.
Oh, well. I got unstuck in time again. So I can say what drops tomorrow, because this is Thursday. Yep. So what drops tomorrow morning, Jimmy?
It is actually based on a recent episode of Catholic Answers Live, where we had someone call in and say he was a Satanist, which I had not known before. You know, that didn't show up in the call screening. And he was concerned that he had extraordinary demonic activity in his life and wanted to know, could it mean he was possessed or going to become possessed or something like that? And I devoted basically the whole first segment of the show to him and gave him an extensive answer. And I realized afterwards, people had questions about it that they posted. And I also realized that there were lessons to be learned from how I handled it. I could point out to people, this is why I did it this way rather than another way. And so I decided to base an episode of Mysterious World on it, both to answer folks' questions and to explain why it's important to take the kind of approach I did to that kind of question.
And now I know what happened to me. You were on Tuesday, and we talked about this week.
Yep.
And so I thought another week had passed.
Yeah.
All right, so I got to give a full 7 days for a week to have passed. 2 days won't do.
That's the general practice of people, yeah. Incidentally, speaking of previous shows, a few weeks ago, you and I were talking on the show about, even though we have a reputation of this being an apologetic show, actually a lot of the questions that we get are not properly speaking apologetics. They're not defending the Catholic faith or the Christian faith. They're actually on other topics. And so I said, why don't in the future we take a show and I'll just point out the different kinds of expertise people are asking about. So I thought today, I'm on for 2 hours. I thought I'd just quickly classify each of the questions we get as to what category it goes in. And that'll help the audience understand the difference between apologetics and other categories. And it will help show just how much Catholic Answers apologists need to know in order to do these open forums, how many different fields they have to have knowledge of.
Yeah. All right. Very good. So we'll do that today. Well, let's get to it. 888-318-7884 is the number. And there's one line open, so you can fill that line. Bill's in Tampa, Florida, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Bill, welcome back. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yeah, I want to thank you guys for being part of my Lent. I've been doing pretty good about calling you twice a week.
I was going to say something about it, but I hope your Lent is going well, Bill.
Yes, it is, and I think I've been throwing some softballs at Jimmy, so I got a tougher one today.
Okay. Well, you can go.
Pope Pius XII's encyclical letter, Humani Generis, maintained that Christ faithful cannot embrace polygenism, since it appears to be in conflict with the teaching on original sin, namely that the sin was actually committed by an individual Adam and through generation is passed on to all. Science currently supports polygenesis and not monogenesis. Does the church allow the faithful to believe in polygenesis? And after you answer that, I've got an if so and if not follow-up.
Okay, well, this answer is not going to please everybody, but if you study Humani Generis carefully, where it talks about this, it does not say that polygenism is false. What it says is that Catholics can't hold it because of, as you said, it appears to conflict with the Church's teaching on original sin. And so when the encyclical was published, that had the effect of focusing attention on could polygenism be reconciled with the doctrine of original sin. And a variety of theologians began to explore that issue, and they began to propose ways that you could harmonize polygenism with the Church's understanding of original sin. And there are different ways that they proposed that could be done. For example, one way that you could propose it is if there was an individual Adam, and if he was a member of a larger human community, but he was the federal head of the human race, so that when he fell into sin, it took everybody else down with him, well, then it wouldn't conflict with the idea of original sin being something committed by our, you know, individual people. There were other proposals that were made too, like maybe Adam, whose name means man, and Eve, whose name means life, were symbols of the early human community, and what the text is saying is that the early human community, living mankind, turned away from God as a whole, and that's how we fell into sin. Regardless of which and there are other speculations too, but regardless of which speculation you prefer, by the 1960s, the Vatican newspaper, L'Osservatore Romano, which at the time, you know, had a very strict control over what was allowed to be printed in it, was publishing articles saying, well, here are some ways that you could harmonize these two. And what you found, if you do a careful study of the subsequent discussion of this question at the church level, you find them progressively taking softer and softer stands on this. So, for example, at a conference on original sin, Pope Paul VI didn't say you couldn't believe polygenism. He just said it hasn't been proved. And early in his tenure, St. John Paul II said the same exact thing. He basically quoted Paul VI. And then later in his tenure, John Paul II alluded back to the restrictions that Pius XII had placed on what Catholics could entertain about evolution, and he repeated all of them except the polygenism restriction. So it's like the Pope seemed to be dropping that. Furthermore, the Vatican reviewed some local catechisms, like the second edition of the Dutch Catechism and the 1980s German Catechism. That one was reviewed under the tenure of Joseph Ratzinger. And these local catechisms said that polygenism could be understood harmoniously with original sin and with the Catholic faith. And the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith approved those catechisms. Then in, I want to say, 2002, the International Theological Commission, which is a body that is run by the congregation, the then Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, and that can only publish a document on the provision that the Holy See has, quote unquote, no difficulty with what the document says, it published a document called Communion and Stewardship, in which it entertained the hypothesis that Adam could have been a symbol of the early human community, and that the human community might have emerged as populations rather than individuals. So at this point, it appears that there's been a fundamental shift in how the magisterium has been handling these things, and it is not maintaining the restriction that Pius XII had placed on this issue. So if someone tells you it is maintaining that restriction, they're simply misinformed.
And I believe you wanted to follow up, Bill, but
I broke my own rule. That question's not apologetics. That question is doctrinal in nature.
Bill, did you have a follow-up? Because it would have to be quick if you've got one.
He did it. It was the if not question, and he told me the he told me how we can reconcile it with original sin. A plus, Jimmy. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I don't know, Bill, if we've ever sent you Jimmy's book, A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. But if we have not sent it to you, I would like to send it to you. Just hang on and Edgar will get your information. While we take this break, we'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Each weekday, we'll dive into the timeless teachings of our Catholic faith, drawing upon the wisdom of the ages to navigate the challenges of today. Together, we'll seek truth, find inspiration, and forge a deeper connection with God. I'm Deacon Harold Burke Sivers, and I invite you to join me for Beacon of Truth, tomorrow at 4 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. We're pulling out all the stops over at shop.catholic.com for Pi Day. That's right. It is Pi Day. That's, you know, the number pi, and it's the 14th of March. Is that right? Is today the 14th of March? I hope it is actually Pi Day. Everything's 31.4% off over at shop.catholic.com. There are a couple of exceptions, but check it all out. It's our Pi Day celebration at shop.catholic.com. And off back to the phones we go. John's in Texas watching on YouTube. John, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Mr. Akin. I hope you're doing well today. I enjoyed your stream earlier with Cameron Bertuzzi on the Boring Heaven objection. I thought of a parody objection to that. Maybe call it the Boring Hell objection. So given an infinite amount of time, why don't all the people in hell eventually repent and turn to God if they're, you know, out of boredom? Or why doesn't God give people an infinite amount of time on earth and out of boredom eventually they'll repent and turn to him?
Okay. So this actually can be classified as an apologetics question since the objection is being posed to the Christian faith itself. I haven't thought deeply about this, but it seems to me that there is an element of mystery here. And that mystery is connected with the fact that God initially gives us freedom to either choose him or choose against him, but that he's also decided there's a limit to when we make that choice, that at the end of our present life, our will, our destiny becomes fixed. And the standard theological opinion on why our destiny becomes fixed is because our will becomes fixed. So if we die in God's friendship, our will is going to be fixed on God and fixed on goodness, and we won't ever change. We'll never repent of that decision, which is why the saints in heaven never fall. On the other hand, if we die with our will fixed against God, in other words, if we die with our will fixed on evil, then we will again never change. And so the proposal of this theological opinion is that the reason that people never leave heaven and the reason people never leave hell is because of how our will works, that our will simply solidifies on whatever decision it made at the end of our lives. And so consequently, that would be the answer as to why people don't get bored with hell and decide to turn to God. In fact, they may be supremely bored in hell. They may be very frustrated by their boredom in hell, but it doesn't result in them changing their will because their will is fixed. Now, beyond that, one could say, okay, well, why did God decide to have our wills become fixed at the moment of death? Why didn't he do something else? And that, I'd have to say, is a mystery. We could speculate further on why God might have made that choice, but I would have to think about it more to see what speculation I thought was the most promising.
John, I'm going to leave it there because all the lines are full. Thank you very much for the call. I'm going up to Canada now. Debbie's in Canada watching on YouTube. Welcome, Debbie. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. And I do enjoy Mysterious World. I called a few months ago, and actually it was yourself that answered my question. And since then, nothing's improved for me. It was in regards to incense being used at our parish. And it's being used 5 days out of seven. And I have, and this is something new, like with a new associate pastor, and he insists on using it. I have multiple chemical sensitivity, like really severely. So even when I attended Mass, and they, and for 30-some years I've been at the same parish, I would attend Mass but have to kind of like move pews if I noticed a fragrance from someone. So incense is beyond what I can handle. Like it just, it makes me ill for the entire rest of the day. So I've spoken to the associate pastor, I've spoken to the pastor, and it doesn't seem that anything is changing. So I can't physically attend Mass. And I'm feeling, even though the pastor said to me, oh, you have a legitimate reason to not attend due to this making you sick, I can't get rid of this feeling that I'm committing a sin. Even though he said he would give me a dispensation, I can watch online. And then I don't like the feeling that I'm starting to have a little tiny bit of resentment in thinking, well, why myself as a person attending, why is that not important over wanting to use the incense, which is not a necessity?
So
5 days out of seven.
Is that what would you like Jimmy to address?
Oh, I would like to know, am I correct in feeling that this sinfulness in not being able to attend?
Okay.
So this is a moral theology question, and the answer is that what the pastor told you is correct. If you can't physically be at Mass because they're using incense all the time and you can't stand the incense, that is a legitimate reason to miss Mass. You don't even need a dispensation from the pastor, and it's not sinful not to go in those circumstances, provided that there's not some other Mass that you could reasonably go to. So that would be my first follow-up question, is there another parish that you could reasonably get to and go to the Masses there? Because that would be the preferred solution if you're not able to attend this particular parish. However, to turn in a from moral theology to canon law, I would say that there are some other options you might want to consider. One of them, now, this is just on a practical suggestion. I don't know if it's possible for you to sit near an exit so that you don't come into contact with the full force of the incense, or if it's possible for them to open a window and let you sit by that, or if it's possible to arrange to attend Mass, like on Sunday, can you at least give me one Mass that I can go to that doesn't have incense? Those are some additional possibilities you might explore at the parish level. But assuming that you can't get satisfaction on the parish level, I would say take it higher. You know, you talk to the associate pastor, which is good. Then you talk to the pastor, which is good. If you can't get satisfaction on the parish level, then it's time to go to the bishop. And so I would write to the bishop and say, here's the situation. And I really want to be able to attend Mass at my parish. And furthermore, you have a right to the sacraments. In fact, the most disturbing thing that you've said to my mind is that the pastor really didn't care about you being able to attend in person. He had said, you know, you could watch online. Well, that's true. And you're not sinning by doing that in this circumstance, but you're being denied Holy Communion. And that's a serious thing. And because you can't receive Holy Communion over the internet. So this is a real problem. And canon law maintains the right of the faithful to be able to receive the sacraments, including Holy Communion. If you, I don't have the numbers of the particular canons off the top of my head, but if you email me at jimmy@catholic.com, I can try to get them for you. But I'd write the bishop and say, here's a situation. I really want to exercise my right to receive Holy Communion. Can you please instruct the pastor to arrange some suitable solution that will enable me to attend Mass and participate in the church's liturgy and receive my Lord Jesus Christ in Holy Communion on a regular basis? That might not be an everyday thing because, you know, you can't shift what a parish is doing fundamentally for a single individual, but what you can do is arrange for something that will be suitable for that single individual. Even if it's just one Mass on Sunday, we're not going to use incense, so you can attend. That's a reasonable thing. And if you don't get satisfaction from the bishop, then there's a next step. You would go to the papal nuncio of Canada and explain the situation to the papal nuncio. And hypothetically, if you didn't get relief there, you could even go to the Vatican. I would suggest calling back on how to, for if you don't get satisfaction in one of these other ways, I would suggest calling back and I can try to help you navigate how to pose it to the Vatican. But the next step would be talking to the bishop if you can't get satisfaction at the parish level. And I'd probably tell the pastor, you know, I'm serious about this. I need to be able to receive communion on a regular basis. And if I'm not able, if we can't arrange that here, then I think we're going to have to consult the bishop for further guidance on this matter. And so I'm going to write him. I tell the pastor that before I write him. And that might shake him up enough that he would arrange an accommodation for you.
Debbie, thank you very much. I hope that's helpful to you. And I hope we'll hear from you again after you try these remedies. And let us know what happened. I'm going to go to Eric in St. Louis, Missouri, listening on 96.7 FM. Eric, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Jimmy. Big fan. Thank you for your work. I have a mysterious world style question. Mm-hmm. My question is, if time is different in heaven and I die and go to heaven, could I be in heaven already? And could I intercede on behalf of myself?
Okay, so this is a theological question, and I would now the way you posed it was in terms of it, assuming that time is different in heaven, and that's there are two issues there. The first one is that's an assumption, and it's an assumption that I don't know that I would make. Because it seems to me that we don't have evidence for time being different in heaven, at least not in a way that would make you already present there. What the church teaches is that all created beings, so that's everything except God, is inside of time. And so we might experience time in heaven in a different way, like it might seem to pass faster or slower than it does for us here on earth. But fundamentally, we're all bound by time. And therefore, only God is truly eternal. Only God is truly outside of time. So we don't leave time when we die. We continue to experience time, although we may perceive it differently. So consequently, I would say you're not already in heaven. At the moment you die, you enter heaven when you die or after you get purified. So that's the first thing I would say. The second thing, though, is you ask, could you intercede for your past self? And I would say, even though you're not already in heaven, once you're in heaven and even before you're in heaven, yes, you can intercede for your past self. I did a whole episode of Mysterious World on what I call time travel prayer, which is asking for things asking God to do things that from our perspective are in the past, but from God's perspective are present to him. Because all times are the past, the present, and the future, they're all present to God right now from his eternal perspective. And so we can pray to God in any time frame and ask him to do something in any one of the time frames that's present to him right now. So right now, you could pray for your past self. You know, you could say, God, I know there are a lot of things I've done in the past that have been mistakes, but please give me the strength in, when I was committing them to repent of them, for example. And you could pray that while you're in purgatory, and you could pray that while you're in heaven, or similar things. The point is, you can ask God to do things in the past as long as you don't know that it's manifestly contrary to his will. And that happens to be episode 208 of Mysterious World. So you could check that out by going to mysterious.com/208.
Thanks, Eric. You can probably hear the music. We got to take a break. The number is 888-318-7884. It's Open Forum with Jimmy Akin. And more of that right after this on Catholic Answers Live. Why We're Catholic is the one book you can hand to anyone to invite them into or back to the Catholic faith. With more than 400,000 copies sold, Trent Horn's book has had a number one ranking on Amazon.com for 5 years running. Now available in softcover, bulk cases, ebook, and on Audible. Find out what the excitement is all about. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic at shop.catholic.com or at a good Catholic bookstore. Visit whyweirecatholic.com.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
Is Orthodoxy an alternative to the Catholic Church? In a time of uncertainty for many Catholics, Orthodoxy can look like greener pastures. Answering Orthodoxy, the new book from Catholic Answers Press, explains why Catholics who are thinking of leaving need to think twice. There are important reasons to remain in the Catholic Church and convincing answers to Orthodox claims. Order your copy of Answering Orthodoxy today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to CASociety315.com and join today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's Open Forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and Thomas the TikTok engine is here with a question from the soon-to-be illegal TikTok or something like that. I really don't know, but
it's more real than it's been all the other times it's happened. I heard the bill that was going to the bill to ban it passed the House, I believe, and now it's got to go through the Senate. So,
but today he's still just a bill.
He is still just a bill at the moment, sitting there on Capitol Hill.
Thomas does know that illusion. Hey,
nicely done that for a young fellow.
That was my favorite Schoolhouse Rock song for a very long time. I remember playing it on repeat many times.
Did they play Schoolhouse Rock on TV, or how did you know it?
We had a collection, DVD collection in my home.
Yeah. What a family. TikTok family.
That's how I know that a noun's a person, place, or thing.
All right. Well, Thomas, the TikTok engine, go ahead and give us your TikTok question for Jimmy.
All right. Thanks, Si. This one came in the comments of a video that we posted back around Christmas time, debunking the normal boilerplate Christmas is pagan or descended from pagan myth stuff. And I discussed in that video how the date of December 25th actually came about. And it's a fixed date for Christmas. And so someone wanted to know, all right, if the date for Christmas is fixed, then why isn't the date for Easter fixed also? Why does it move around?
Okay, so this is a historical question, and the answer is because Jesus was crucified at Passover. Passover is, the timing of Passover moves around in the calendrical year based on the spring equinox and the phase of the moon. And so Passover, the precise definition has varied from time to time, but you can think of it as basically the first full moon on or after the spring equinox. And so because the timing of the moon varies and isn't synced to our months, the time of Passover floats. And therefore, Easter Sunday, which is the Sunday after Passover, or at least Passover as it was celebrated in the first century, that Easter Sunday also floats, and so it's a movable feast. Now, there's some complications in that the Jewish calendar has diverged from the Gregorian calendar in certain ways, but those are the basic principles. Christians remembered that Jesus was resurrected on the Sunday after Passover, and Passover moves. Now, there was actually a dispute about this in the early church because Passover falls on the 14th of Nisan, and this led to a group of early Christians in the second century saying, we ought to just celebrate it on the 14th of Nisan, whatever day of the year that falls, whether or not it's a Sunday or whatever it may be. And they were known as Quarto Decimians, for the Latin word for 14. But their opinion did not prevail, and so Easter became a movable feast, and Christmas did not, because Christ wasn't born, so far as we know, in terms of any particular holiday. And so the dates for Christmas were always fixed, since his birth was not tied to a movable holiday.
Great. Thank you, Jimmy. Can we get that turned into a Schoolhouse Rock song, too?
I'm sure we have the talent in the building. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of bandwidth.
We
do
I
have
understand.
Things to do. I can't believe that was better than Conjunction for you.
Ugh, it's a tight race.
Really? Because I don't think a Conjunction is the winner. I don't know.
I liked Hey Little 12 Toes.
Oh, you like the idea about counting in base 12? That weirded me out for some reason.
Yeah.
I don't remember that.
It's part of their multiplication rock series. Mm-hmm. They did 2 through 12. And 12 was the last, but it involves an alien flying around, and he's got 12 toes, and he counts in base 12 instead of base 10. And it was a cool video, and I liked UFOs and aliens and stuff, but the problem was they almost never played that one. I remember them playing 3 and 5 and 10, and they played the others a lot, but they almost never played Hey Little 12 Toes on Saturday morning TV.
It might have been because the concept of base 12 was a little too abstract for elementary school
minds. Poor little
minds.
Jimmy Akin. Yeah. Like, he's like, that's the one that appeals to me, is base 12.
Bummer.
Well, thank you, Thomas.
Thank you, Si. Thank you, Jimmy.
Let's go to Peter in Syracuse, New York, listening on Catholic.com. That's our website, Catholic.com. Hello, Peter. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hello, and thank you. I have a couple questions, but the first one, again, humani generis, but this time on the earlier paragraphs 5 and 6, it seems like Pope Pius XII was condemning continual evolution. Mm-hmm. What exactly did he mean by continual evolution in this context?
Okay, so this could be considered a doctrinal question or a historical question, but in order to flesh out the context, we need to read it. Now, one of the things that should be understood about Humani Generis is that Pius XII is reacting to opinions that were current in some circles in his day, like at one point in paragraph 5, he's going to mention communists, but he's also responding in particular to the ideas of a theologian named Hans Urs von Balthasar. And I've just given the wrong name. I'm sorry. I was confused by the fact that Hans Urs von Balthasar has four names. I was thinking of Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. And so Pierre Teilhard de Chardin was an anthropologist who wrote about evolution, and he tried to integrate it with theology in ways that were rather daring. For example, one of the things that Teilhard de Chardin proposed is that there's this kind of cosmic evolution happening to the whole universe that will result in everything evolving to something that he called the Omega Point, which was in some way identified with Jesus Christ or God or something like that. So he saw there being a kind of evolution that went beyond the types of evolution that natural science talks about. For example, I mean, in natural science, they'll talk about cosmic evolution, you know, which is the origin of the stars and planets and things like that. And then they'll talk about biological evolution. Well, Teilhard de Chardin had this spiritual evolution that he thought applied in some way to the whole cosmos, with us heading towards this Omega Point, which had messianic significance for him. Others, like communists, would hold that there was a social evolution that was inevitable, that would produce the destruction of religion and the triumph of communism, of atheistic communism. So you had multiple different ideas of evolution that were in circulation. So with that as background, here's what Pius XII says in paragraph 5. He says, "If anyone examines the state of affairs outside the Christian fold, he will easily discover the principal trends that not a few learned men are following. Some imprudently and indiscreetly hold that evolution, which has not been fully proven even in the domain of the natural sciences." So that tells us he's not just talking about the kinds of evolution that natural sciences talked about. He's saying those haven't been fully proved. He's referring to cosmic evolution, which he actually believed in, and biological evolution, which he didn't have a problem with. But he's saying even those haven't been fully proved, but he's going beyond that. He's thinking of more than that. Anyway, he says that that evolution hasn't been fully proved, even in the domain of the natural sciences, explains the origin of all things, and audaciously support the monistic and pantheistic opinion that the world is in continual evolution. So monism is the idea that there's just one kind of substance, typically matter, although some people might propose some other substance, but matter is one of the principal popular forms of monism in the mid-20th century when he's writing. And pantheist, he also talks about this being a pantheistic opinion, which identifies God with the world. So the idea is God does not transcend the world, God is the world. And that this continual evolution is the force that governs this monistic and pantheistic conception of the world. He says, "Communists gladly subscribe to this opinion so that when the souls of men have been deprived of every idea of a personal God, they may the more efficaciously defend and propagate their dialectical materialism," which is the philosophical worldview of the communists, that the world is materialistic, so it's all matter, it's monistic in that way, and there is a dialectic. You can hear how, you know, dialogue involves two or more people. Well, communists believed that there were two or more forces that were in tension with each other in the world that drove social evolution forward. And thus, the class system that prevailed was bound to fall, religion was bound to fall, communism was bound to triumph. And this was all because of this continual evolution that they saw happening in the world, not just in realms of science, but in realms of society and in a greater spiritual sense. And so that's the kind of evolution he's talking about here. It's a philosophical principle rather than a scientific principle. And he, as he's going to go on to say later in the encyclical, he doesn't have a problem with scientific evolution as long as certain conditions are maintained. But if you want to say, no, the whole thing, it's unrestricted cosmic evolution of life and society and spirituality and everything, that's a problem for him.
Peter, you had a follow-up. Can you be very quick with it?
I'm just trying to... I don't know if this is going to be quick, so you can feel free not to answer if it becomes too impossible. It's just trying to reconcile. What's that?
What's the question?
What's the question?
Reconciling Arcanum Divinae, paragraph 5, with what is said in Dei Filius, talking about how the meaning of dogmas can't be changed once the Church has declared them, and their meaning can never be departed from. And Arcanum Divinae talks about how basically Eve was created directly from Adam, on the sixth day of creation, having made man from the slime of the earth, et cetera.
Okay, I don't have the text of Arcanum Divinum in front of me, so I really can't comment on that. What I can comment on, you also quoted from the First Vatican Council, and in talking about dogmas, and we have to understand what a dogma is. A dogma is not anything that has been said in a church document. A dogma is an occasion where the church's magisterium has infallibly declared a particular truth to be divinely revealed by God, not learned in some other way, but it's infallibly said this is part of divine revelation. And the church has not done that for Eve and her specific origin. There are no places where an ecumenical council or a pope or whatever uses the kind of language needed to issue an infallible definition regarding the origin of Eve. And consequently, there is room for liberty of opinion on that. In fact, John Paul II interpreted the creation of Eve not as an indication of what would have happened on camera if you were filming it, where God literally puts Adam to sleep and literally takes out one of his ribs and literally fashions a woman out of it. Instead, he took that as an affirmation, using symbolic language, of the fundamental equality of man and woman and how they have the same human nature. And so regardless of how this has been expressed and how it's been interpreted in prior documents, the church has simply never declared a specific interpretation of that text to be a truth that has been infallibly settled on as part of divine revelation. And therefore, even if you propose a different understanding of the specific method of Eve's creation, you're not violating a dogma. We're in some pretty deep waters here, and I don't really have time to dwell on them because I know we need to take a break. But I wrote a whole book about church teaching and how to understand these matters, and it's called Teaching with Authority. Cy, maybe we can send Peter a copy of Teaching with Authority.
Peter, thank you for the call very much. Hang on. If you'll give your information to Edgar, we'll send you Teaching with Authority. We'll take a quick break. Be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, this is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Keep your dial tuned to Catholic Answers Live.
In Morse code, the sequence SOS is a distress call. It's been said that it stands for Save Our Souls. Well, right now our world is in big trouble, and we're putting out an SOS call for help. Will you answer that call? St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, has hundreds of teams who share the good news with souls who don't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to get involved.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
I don't like looking back. I prefer to look forward and keep moving forward. There's plenty to cover. I do a lot of research and try to dig out the bits and pieces of a life or of an agenda that people don't want to talk about.
The World Over with Raymond Arroyo. Tonight, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and Television.
Open Forum today, both hours, with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live. And all but one line full. You're welcome to call and get on that one if you've got a question about just about anything for Jimmy Akin. 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. Jonathan's in Idaho listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Jonathan, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, guys. I've done some reading from the Catechism on authority, violence, and just war. And I'm wondering, considering that we live in a time where our state tax dollars fund abortion, and there seems to be a lot of unjust laws, when is a revolution or acts of violence like burning down an abortion clinic or not paying taxes or even submitting to the authority of the government deemed justified or even necessary? Seems like the American Revolution, you know, happened for a lot less than what we're dealing with now.
Okay, so this is a moral theology question, and it also has a catechetical aspect. According to paragraph 2243, armed resistance to oppression by political authority is not legitimate unless all of the following conditions are met. One, there is certain grave and prolonged violation of fundamental rights. Two, all other means of redress have been exhausted. Three, such resistance will not provoke worse disorders. Four, there is a well-founded hope of success. And five, it is impossible reasonably to foresee any better solution. So if you want to use armed resistance to political authority, you're going to need to have all of those conditions fulfilled. Now, you kind of proposed several different things there. Burning down an abortion clinic may not be considered armed resistance to political authority. That may just be a crime. And that would need to be handled separately. But if you're talking about going to war with the state, those are the conditions that need to be fulfilled. And frankly, I don't see any of them. I don't see all five of them being jointly fulfilled right now in the United States. In particular, there is condition number four. There is a well-founded hope of success. Does not seem to me to be fulfilled at present. So no matter how bad things are, just badness itself does not give you the right to take up arms against the state. You need to be able to reasonably win, among other things, as well as four other conditions. And so I don't think anybody starting a revolution today against the U.S. government is going to win. Furthermore, condition number five, that it won't provoke worse disorders. Well, I suspect it's likely to provoke worse disorders, because if you, let's say you wanted to overthrow the U.S. government because of the degree of latitude it allows for abortion in the United States, you would make pro-lifers look horrendously bad if you lead an armed revolution. And that would be worse than the situation we're in now. So condition five would not be fulfilled. And you would impede the progress that has been made and is continuing to be made on the abortion front. I mean, we don't have Roe v. Wade anymore. You know, that's a huge victory. And it's just the real beginning of the struggle to end abortion in this in this nation, because previously Roe v. Wade was in place and we couldn't make progress on the local level. Now we can make progress. And that means condition three is the lack of all other recourses have been exhausted. Well, we're not in that state right now. We have other recourses. We can work on the local level, like you said, state taxes being used to support abortion. We'll work on the state level to change that. So I see multiple reasons why an abortion rallying revolution would not have these conditions fulfilled. And frankly, the U.S. military is so powerful that, I mean, it's the most powerful military force in the history of the world. I don't think anybody is going to be able to fulfill condition four and have a reasonable hope of success in leading a revolution against the U.S. government.
Yeah, thanks, Jimmy. I kind of wrapped a whole bunch of questions into one, and my problem really is just with submitting to authority, I guess. You had some good points there. I'm just curious about, you know, when does now, what comes to mind is, when does an authority, you know, figure lose its privilege of authority, considering, you know, all
okay,
of
well,
the...
Okay, well, if we're talking about a moral right to rule as opposed to having an effective right to rule, well, to the extent a ruling authority issues unjust laws or policies, those are morally illegitimate, and they at least create carve-outs where they have no moral authority on those matters, you know, when they implement such a policy. If it's a question of when do they fundamentally, from a moral perspective, fall from office or lose any moral right to rule, it's when they no longer have the consent of the people that they rule. The consent of the governed is a requirement for holding office. And so if the people that they govern no longer consent to be governed by that person, then they have no right, morally speaking, to continue in governance. Even if they have the power to enforce them, they've lost all authority. But beyond that, beyond losing the consent of the people, they don't fundamentally lose the right to govern. What they can do is effectively lose the right to speak on a particular issue by issuing an immoral policy on that issue, but that doesn't prevent them from ruling justly on other issues.
Jonathan, thank you very much. Jimmy, I'm sorry that I missed it, but those 5 points you gave, where did they come from?
This is paragraph 2243 in the Catechism of the Catholic Church.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Jonathan. I hope that was helpful to you. Uriah is in Minnesota listening on Real Presence Radio. Uriah, can you be quick with your question and give Jimmy a chance to answer it?
Probably not, but I'll give it a shot here.
That was honest.
Great to talk with you, Cy and Jimmy, but... yeah, I mean, this has everything to do with
Uriah, how would you phrase this in the form of a question?
Yeah, so those that are of Jewish background, are they still obligated to participate in the feast days?
Christian no. people?
He said those of a Jewish background. So are they still required to participate in the Jewish feast days? He's implying that they've now become Christian. And the answer is no. There was some confusion about this in the first century. But even in the first century, St. Paul indicated that he was not bound to observe the Mosaic law anymore. He says, you know, I become all things to win all men. To Jews, I become a Jew. To Gentiles, I become a Gentile. He was not bound to observe the Mosaic law. And he explores that a little further in Colossians chapter 2, where he says that all of those Old Testament ceremonies, they pointed forward to Christ. Christ was like the substance that cast them backwards in history as a shadow. So they all pointed forward to the substance of Christ. But he says now that the substance is here, we no longer have those regulations. And so he says, therefore, don't let anybody judge you in meat or in drink or in a Sabbath or a new moon or a festival. The Sabbath, the new moons, and the festivals being the three kinds of liturgical days on the liturgical calendar. So he says those things were good for their time. They pointed forward to Christ. But now that Christ is here, we're not obliged to keep Sabbaths or new moons or festivals. And he's not making any restriction about except for the Jews, because it was only ever the Jews that were bound to keep Sabbaths and new moons and festivals. Gentiles were never required to do those. And so he's clearly indicating here that Jews, like him, are no longer bound to keep those festivals. He also elsewhere says Christ is the end of the law, meaning he terminated the Mosaic law.
Uriah, thank you very much. I hope that that got to what you wanted. I'm sorry that I got you on so late. But that happens sometimes. Call back if you need a follow-up sometime. We have to take a quick break. There's probably going to be two lines open while we're on the break. So if you have a question for Jimmy Akin, whether you're Catholic or not, whether you're Christian or not, whoever you are, if you've got a question and you'd like to call, the number is 888-318-7884. Right back with more. Oh, go ahead.
And that was a theological question. Biblical question, technically.
You didn't keep score, though, did you?
No, I haven't been, but I can total them up later.
All right, we'll be right back after this. More Open Forum with Jimmy on Catholic Answers Live.